Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Aram Nagusium, who is a visiting fellow with the Arleigh Burke Chair of Strategy at the Center for Strategic International Studies, where he specializes in security, politics, and military development in the Middle East, focusing on the Lebanese military, U.S. and Iranian strategic competition in the Levant, and challenges to civil-military relations in post-conflict and divided societies. He has authored or co-authored a number of reports at CSIS, including Instability in Syria, Assessing the Risks of Military Intervention, U.S.-Iranian Strategic Competition, the Proxy Cold War in the Levant, and he is the author of Israel and Syria, The Military Balance and the Prospects of War. Welcome to Background Briefing, Aram Nagusium.
I'm happy to be back, Ian.
And can you connect some of the dots for us that are out there, Aram, in terms of, for example, I mean, I know they're all over the place, but you've got the Israelis deploying their Iron Dome anti-missile system on the Syrian border with comments from senior Israeli officials that the Iranians have brought in Hezbollah fighters into the war in Syria, and that they may turn over chemical weapons to Hezbollah. You've got the former foreign minister of Iran, now an aide to the Ayatollah, the supreme leader, saying that Iran considers any attack against Syria an attack on itself. And you've got Israel's departing defense minister, Ehud Barak, at Davos, saying that the Pentagon has prepared sophisticated blueprints of surgical scalpel-like operations to neutralize Iran's nuclear program. So I'm giving you a difficult, an unenviable task there. But is there anything to all of these movements in this increasingly complex proxy war?
Well, certainly there's a lot. Complexity, you pointed out to a lot of it, and I'll try to condense it in less than our usual 300-page reports. But basically, you have an arena that has grown increasingly complex. It is only natural for countries like Israel, Jordan, Turkey, even Lebanon and Iraq to try and map out contingencies based on their domestic political arenas. The Israelis have been tracking especially activity along the Golan for some time. You know, A lot of the posturing by the Assad regime about opening up a front on the Golan has been perceived by analysts in the West as little more than posturing, an effort to shift the focus away from the country's internal crisis. But the reality is that you have a multi-vector conflict, you have moderate fighting factions in the opposition, you have a number of extremist elements, you have a regime that is changing, you have an insurgency that is changing, and in that, you do have the prospect of some of these fighting groups mobilizing a very broad and publicly accepted view that Israel is the opponent of the average Syrian, that there are domestic grievances that can be utilized in the struggle. And I would not be surprised if at some point you had elements of the opposition that tried to gain more public support, gain more legitimacy by undertaking activities either on or close to the Golan Heights. And you have an Israeli defense establishment that's going to try and act according to that. And the challenge is not just from some of these groups that are fighting Assad. You also have an Assad regime that is learning, that is adapting, and that is finding new ways to compete and to combat the insurgency. And part of that is their own new tactics and utilizing Syrian resources. But the other side of this is that the Iranians, along with Hezbollah, have been very active in trying to shift some of the terms of the balance of power in the country. You remember, you have a predominantly Sunni opposition that includes some moderates, but increasingly is being personified by the successes of more extreme groups, in some cases groups with ties to al-Qaeda, like the Nusra Front. For better or for worse, countries in the Gulf like Qatar and Saudi Arabia and also Turkey and indirectly the West have been supporting this Sunni majority insurgency to varying degrees. And on the other side of this, you have Iran, and in many ways with Iraqi Shiites and Lebanese Shiites that have been buttressing the other side of this alongside the Assad regime. And while there are concerns in Israel about chemical weapon transfers to Hezbollah, that's nothing really new. We've been hearing about this for quite some time. Frankly, I think the concerns of that are far more vocal here in Western capitals, I think that the Israelis have a much more nuanced local understanding of where they fit in the balance of terror with Hezbollah. I mean, Hezbollah has a lot to lose, especially if they were to acquire systems like those that are in Syrian inventory in terms of chemical weapons. I mean, they're already dealing with significant transfers of weapons over the last 20 months. The Assad regime has accelerated the scale and the pace of transfers in 2011 and in parts of 2012. But there's only so much that Hezbollah can absorb in terms of transfers without having problems in hiding its inventory and without exposing itself to undue risk of attack from Israel. So you have a Hezbollah backed by Iran that is on the one hand engaged in helping the Assad regime, and I'd be happy to talk about how they're doing that, but at the same time trying to stave off the perception that somehow they are preparing for direct confrontation with the Israelis. And the message that I got during my last trip to the region is that the Shiites of Lebanon are basically juggling multiple agendas. They're juggling an effort to fight alongside Assad for very pragmatic and very self-interested reasons, namely in their own perception of where they fit in a broader regional Sunni-Shiite contest, where if Assad were to lose, it would somehow threaten the autonomy of Hezbollah, but also the political autonomy of Shiites in Lebanon. But at the same time, trying to minimize tension with Lebanon's own Sunni community. And at the same time, on a third front, trying to mitigate against any miscommunication or false flags with the Israelis in order to avert a conflict with the Israelis, which would probably expose Hezbollah at a time when they're trying to do all things at the same time without triggering a major escalation on any of the key fronts that they're concerned with. So, you know, if we thought Syria was going to be complex, it's only getting more complex. This is only talking about a very limited number of the interested actors involved in the conflict. If you were to talk about things tied to Jordan, Turkey, Iraq, you can imagine similar layers of complexity. So this lays out where things sit vis-a-vis Israel, Hezbollah, and Syria.
So, Aram Nirgizian, again, visiting fellow with the Ali Burke Chair in Strategy at the Center for Strategic International Studies. The Syrian opposition and their international sponsors are meeting in Paris. They've had a series of meetings. There's always been a confidence in the West that Assad will go, largely expressed by outgoing Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. On the other hand, Iran seems to be confident that they're able to supply. And so I think to some extent the Russians, although there have been rumors of Russians evacuating, give us a sense of what's really happening in terms of who's winning or losing. Because my impression is this thing could go on for a long time, in spite of the optimistic statements from Hillary Clinton.
Well, you'd be right about that, Ian, and there's a reason why we've been very careful about the kinds of analysis we put out, because there are two defining qualities of the cycle of confrontation in Syria. The first is that both the opposition, and that's a very loose term, I mean, I'm not even comfortable using the term Free Syrian Army anymore, or as a very generalized term to describe the armed insurgency. Well, the opponents of the Assad regime and the Assad regime first are both learning, adapting, and figuring out new ways to fight what is essentially a war of attrition. The opposition benefits from external support from the Gulf, political and in some cases logistical support from Turkey, and just the overarching level of support from within the Sunni community, whether it's in terms of Muslim Brotherhood support at the regional level or in terms of the broader dividing fault line between Sunni Saudi Arabia and Shiite Iran. But the problem there is that the Assad regime is also learning, also adapting. They have changed their strategy. They're focusing far less on major offensive operations in the north. They're focusing on defending the inner core of the regime tied to Damascus and key urban centers and not losing major ones like Aleppo outright. And in parallel to that, they're also finding new ways to relieve pressure from the Assad regime. So things like creating this national defense army of new recruits, and also really trying to beef up, in terms of quantity and quality, the Shabiha and other loyalist and sectarian units. So this is the first key pattern, which is that as one side learns, the other side learns as well, which means that you have this potential long-term cycle of attrition, which is being fueled by local, regional, and international forces. The other key factor, and this is something that is difficult to say, but it really is a defining dimension of this conflict during an age of high speed and instant communication, is that you essentially have a liar's contest. You have an Assad regime that is trying to frame a narrative that of victory, that they can achieve complete victory against the opposition. And you also have an opposition that is working very hard to shape reality. Now, this is nothing new. In any civil conflict, let alone broader intrastate conflict, you do have both sides engaged in propaganda and information warfare. This is no different. It's just that it's happening during an age where you have Twitter, where you have YouTube, and where you have a role for a free press, but a free press that, frankly, is not able to perform in ways that provides the average observer with realistic metrics. Even if you did have a strong press presence in Syria, you have important lessons from Lebanon and from Iraq, which are that at some point, whether it's the media, whether it's analysts, whether it's elements of national intelligence agencies, you come to a stark conclusion, which is that whenever a conflict like this drags on as long as it does, we just don't know. We just don't have a clear sense of where the metrics really are, which is why talking about tipping points, talking about game-changing moments, all of these things can be very quickly trivialized by the fact that the balance of power is shifting constantly. We've been talking about Assad's eventual departure for the last almost year and a half now. And it's important to remember, Ian, that at the beginning of this debate, when you had the State Department and the Department of Defense advising the White House about what the official guidance should be, it was very clear to me from the onset that there was a lot of reluctance within the Department of Defense to move quickly on this idea that Assad should be called on to leave by the president. And in many ways, if you look at where this all started in terms of the U.S. posture and where things stand now, one thing remains consistent, and that is that it's not so much about the U.S. leading from behind, it is about the U.S. being pushed from behind, pushed by regional events, pushed by regional allies, pushed by regional and international opponents. And that's where things stand now. We still have no clear picture where this is all going. There are no good options on the table in what is an existential conflict for the Alawites and what is a struggle for the post-Ottoman legacy in Syria. And as you pointed out, this conflict could go on for many, many more years, which is why, while we are tempted to think about things like intervention and military action, the lesson, again, from a conflict from previous decades, like the Lebanese Civil War, is that you will have multiple efforts to win by competing factions, and you will have multiple efforts to solve and settle the conflict with peace agreements. And while there might be a dozen such efforts, at some point, either because of luck or by a change in the balance, one of those efforts might actually stick. And as pessimistic as my assessment might sound to a lot of folks who know the work we do, there is a long-term optimism here, which is that at some point you have to negotiate an outcome. The alternative is that at some point we're going to look back and say, wow, 60,000 fatalities was actually a low number. We've hit the multiple 100,000 levels, similar to the Algeria conflict. And that's not somewhere anybody wants to be, let alone the leadership here in the United States government.
Well, just in closing in the last couple of minutes, Aram Nagezian, so in the meanwhile, Syria is being destroyed and its citizens are being turned into refugees and there's no end in sight. And it does seem that, at least in terms of the Iranians and the Russians to a lesser degree, they seem to at least know what they're doing. We seem to, in the West and particularly the United States, seem to know what we don't want, but we don't know what we do want.
One of the core challenges is that the Iranians and the Russians, for different reasons and with different end states in mind, have a similar overarching strategy, which is not to lose, versus the approach of countries like the United States, which is predicated on winning. winning means defeating Assad, creating a stable government that tries to represent the maximum amount of people in Syria, eventually creating a stable peace environment or a peace process of some kind, and holding all of this together despite the fact that you've had tens of thousands of fatalities. Frankly, the challenge facing Iran and Russia is much easier, or at least not as daunting. What could happen in their case is if they lose Assad, they will have to face the prospect of finding new ways to maintain or sustain the equilibrium that exists today in the Levant, which means that if you have Assad leave power, or if he's assassinated, or if some other major shift comes along, Iran and their regional international allies will find some way to make sure that a stable pro-Western government does not emerge, let alone a Sunni-dominated one. So the thresholds are fundamentally different. You have a U.S. and a country that is focused on humanitarian and economic development on the one hand, and their allies at the regional international level with a broad mix of strategies versus Iran and Russia. The other challenge is, frankly, that 2 years on, if you were to try and peg where U.S. policy sits in terms of where the lead is, where the leadership is, who the key players in the U.S. interagency are, well, if we knew that a year ago, and frankly we didn't, now you have even more instability given the fact that you have a shuffle within the National Security Council. You have new appointments due in the State Department and the Department of Defense. So it's not to say that U.S. policy is in flux. It's just that we have no more direction than we did a few months ago.
Well, Aram Nagizian, I thank you so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Aram Nagizian, who's a visiting fellow with the Ali Burke Chair of Strategy at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, where he specializes in security politics and military development in the Middle East, focusing on the Lebanese military, U.S. and Iranian strategic competition in the Levant, and challenges to civil-military relations in post-conflict and divided societies. He has authored and co-authored a number of reports at CSIS, including Instability in Syria, Assessing the Risk of Military Intervention, U.S.-Iranian Strategic Competition, The Proxy Cold War in the Levant, and he is the author of Israel and Syria, The Military Balance and the Prospects of War. We're going to take a brief station break and we're back talking about Republican efforts to rig the vote in the Electoral College.
Come, senators, congressmen, please heed the call. Don't stand in the doorway, don't lock up the hall. For he that gets hurt will be he who has stalled. The battle outside raging will soon shake your windows and rattle your walls, for the times they are a-changin'.